Well, there's a book which someone gave my mother for Christmas entitled Very British Problems by Rob Temple. Some of you may have seen the book. It lists, amusingly, hundreds of everyday predicaments that are peculiar to Brits. And so here are a few of them. Feeling guilty for making traffic stop at the lights when you need to cross the road. Looking away so violently as someone enters their PIN that you accidentally dislocate your neck. Chuckling heartily after walking into a lamppost, despite a strong suspicion that you've broken your cheek. Concentrating so hard on the appropriate eye contact to looking away ratio that you've no idea what's been said to you. Going to your doctor and replying, "I'm fine, thank you," when they ask you how you are. And in the same way, then, that each of those scenarios makes us smile and say, "That's so British," perhaps on reading the first 17 verses of Matthew's Gospel, we're inclined similarly to smile and say, "That's so Jewish," rather than starting with the events surrounding Jesus' birth, as Dr. Luke does. Matthew, as a dyed-in-the-wool Jew, he just can't resist an introductory genealogy. And it's probably not entirely unjustified to react in that way. Doubtless, to some extent, he is reflecting here a cultural fascination with matters of heritage and ancestry. But at the same time, it would be wrong to dismiss these verses as though they are merely Matthew's Jewishness getting the better of him. That's not the case. Yes, he may be writing as a Jew, predisposed to think in genealogical categories, but he's also, of course, writing as a spirit-inspired theologian. And in this genealogy, therefore, he's making important theological points. More specifically, he's making important statements about Jesus, whose genealogy, of course, this is. And so that's how I want us to approach this genealogy this morning. I want us to notice in it three important statements about Jesus that Matthew is making. And so statement number one then, Jesus inherits the throne. Jesus inherits the throne. There's something strange about the way that Matthew introduces this genealogy there in verse 1. So he says, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." Now, the reference to Jesus being the son of Abraham is understandable because Abraham's is the first name in the ensuing genealogy. He, of course, is the great patriarch on which the whole thing is founded. David, on the other hand, well, he's one name within the genealogy. And so it raises the question, why is he singled out in that introductory verse? Why is it any more significant that Jesus is the son of David than that Jesus is the son of Nashon, for instance, mentioned in verse 4? Or that Jesus is the son of Eliakim, mentioned in verse 13? What's the big deal about David? Well, the big deal about David becomes clear when we come to his slot in the genealogy in verse 6. And we read there, "Jesse, the father of David, the king." The king. Now that's clearly significant because this genealogy doesn't tell us the occupation of any other individual that's mentioned. Doesn't tell us that Boaz was a farmer. Doesn't tell us that Joseph was a carpenter. Thankfully, it spares us the details as to how Rahab earned her living. But it does tell us then that David was a king. And that must be the reason then that David is mentioned in the introductory verse there in verse 1. Matthew surely is saying in that introductory verse, what I'm about to set out here is specifically a royal genealogy. This is not simply about demonstrating that Jesus is a Jew connected to Abraham. No, this is about demonstrating that Jesus is a king connected to David. He's an heir to David's throne. And indeed, it's not just in his mention of David there in verse 1 and the reference to David's kingship in verse 6 that Matthew makes this point. It's evident, I think, in the way that he structures this whole genealogy. Structurally, there are two interesting things that Matthew does. So the first thing, he divides the genealogy into three sections, doesn't he? So that's not simply the editors of the ESV that have done that by their paragraph breaks in the middle of verse 6 and at the end of verse 11. It's Matthew who explicitly divides the genealogy into three sections by what he says in verse 17. It's quite clear from his summary there at the end that he's dividing the genealogy into three sections. But then the second interesting thing he does structurally, he divides it into three equal sections. 14 generations. 14 generations, 14 generations. Now, some of you will be aware then that this genealogy is selective. It's not exhaustive. So the first section of the genealogy from Abraham down to David there, Matthew is simply copying and pasting a couple of Old Testament genealogies, and almost certainly they are selective. I mean, the generations mentioned, for instance, between Rahab and David, they are too few to span the chronological gap between Rahab and David. So probably there are some names that are omitted between Rahab and Boaz. And then when we come to the second section, from David down to Jeconiah, there we know for sure that Matthew has omitted names. He's omitted Ahaziah, Joash and Amaziah, three kings of Judah, whom we encounter in the Old Testament, who are documented in the books of Kings and Chronicles. As for the third section, we have no other sources for most of the names mentioned there, so we can't tell whether Matthew is being selective or not. But my point then is this. We have three equal sections here because Matthew has deliberately made them three equal sections. Like all ancient genealogists, he felt at liberty to select and to omit. And so it's by his design then that the whole thing is so neatly balanced. It's not coincidence, it's Matthew who has made the genealogy so neatly balanced. So those are the two structural features. Why does Matthew structure it in this way? Three sections, and not just three sections, but three equal sections. Well, I think it's to enable him to do that very Jewish thing and give the passage a center point where the main emphasis is to be found. I mean, that's a technique that we've often commented on before. Those of you who come to Time Out, we saw it particularly in the book of Lamentations, where it's not just one passage, but I think the whole book of Lamentations is structured in that way, with a center point where the main emphasis lies. We've seen it at points also in the book of Hebrews. It's a very Jewish technique, the center point of a passage containing the passage's main emphasis. And Matthew then wants the kings of Judah to be the center point of this genealogy. And so he employs these structural devices. If he hadn't divided it into three sections, if he just left it as one long list, then we might well have missed the center point. And if he hadn't divided it into three equal sections, then that imbalance might well have confused us. And again, we might well have missed the center point. But with the genealogy arranged in this way, we can't miss the center point. The kings of Judah are the center points. And why then does Matthew so want to emphasize kings? Well, again, in order to indicate that this is a royal genealogy. And that the one, therefore, whose genealogy it is, Jesus, is in that same category as those men in the middle. David and Solomon and so on. He's a king who, like them, inherits the throne. By the way, I think this may well explain better than other theories why Matthew's genealogy here diverges so conspicuously from Luke's genealogy there in chapter 3 of his gospel. Luke, in his genealogy, once he's reached David, although he actually goes the other way around, but once he's reached David, he then proceeds via David's son Nathan, not Solomon. And so then, instead of having Rehoboam and all the rest, we have a whole list of obscure individuals. And this has puzzled many then, and I think the explanation probably is that Luke's genealogy is a mere genealogy. And in strict genealogical terms then, Jesus, or Joseph, probably is in the line of Nathan. Incidentally, that means that Bathsheba is still involved, of course, because Nathan, like Solomon, was David's son through Bathsheba. But Luke's genealogy, I'm saying, it's a mere genealogy. Matthew's, on the other hand, isn't. It's a royal genealogy. And so just as the second Saturday in June is our Queen's birthday, not in biological terms, her birthday is in April, but in an official sense, in her capacity as queen, her official birthday is then. So this genealogy of Jesus that we have here is his genealogy in his capacity as king. It's his official genealogy. As king, he's in the line of Solomon, not in the line of Nathan, who never occupied the throne of Israel or Judah. So I'm saying then that this is the major statement that Matthew is making in this genealogy, from whichever angle you want to look at it. Whether you want to look at it from the angle of its strange introduction there in verse 1, he's the son of David. Whether you want to look at it from the angle of its carefully arranged structure with a center point where the main emphasis lies. Whether you want to look at it from the angle of its divergence from Luke's genealogy in Luke chapter 3. Whichever way you look at it, it's saying loudly and clearly, Jesus inherits the throne. He's a king in the line of David. And presumably not just a king in the line of David. Because there were kings in the line of David who weren't worth devoting 17 verses of genealogy to. In fact, we've already said this morning, there were kings in the line of David that Matthew here in this passage doesn't even acknowledge ever existed. But remember that we read earlier on in our service that passage in Isaiah chapter 11, where we encounter Isaiah prophesying that one day a special king in the line of David will emerge, a special shoot from the stump of Jesse, as he puts it. Or as the hymn writer puts it, great David's greater son. And presumably then, Matthew is saying here that Jesus inherits the throne in that sense. He inherits the throne as the one to whom the throne supremely belongs. That's why he refers three times to Jesus as Christ here. Jesus is the Christ King, the Messiah King. He's the King in the line of David, the special God-sent King. And so that's the first major statement then that Matthew is making here in this genealogy. Jesus inherits the throne. The second statement he's making, Jesus ingathers the exiles. Jesus ingathers the exiles. Now, many of you know your Old Testament history reasonably well. I want you to imagine for a moment that you don't. And with little knowledge then of Judah's story, you're coming to this passage here. What are you going to conclude about Judah's situation at the birth of Jesus? Well, you're going to conclude, are you not, that Judah is in exile in Babylon. I mean, look at verse 17. All the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. There's no hint there, is there, of anything significant taking place between the deportation to Babylon and the birth of Jesus, anything that modified or reversed the deportation to Babylon. Now, of course, we know that 70 years after the deportation to Babylon, there had been that decree from Cyrus, the Persian emperor, allowing the Jews to return to Jerusalem. And we know that there had been a return, not of all the exiles by any means, but of a good number of them. And we know then that during the times of Ezra and Nehemiah, there had been that building project, and the temple had been rebuilt, and the walls of the city had been rebuilt, and so on. We know all that, but you would never guess it, would you, from Matthew chapter 1 here. You get the impression from Matthew here that Judah still languishes under that divine judgment that fell so decisively in 586 BC. Why then? Why does Matthew leave us with that impression? Is it simply that he doesn't want to mess up this careful threefold structure that we've talked about? And so he hasn't got any room to put another event in between the exile and the birth of Jesus? Well, I think there's more to it than that. I think Matthew is saying here that in a real sense, Judah does still languish under that divine judgment. It's interesting that later in the chapter, Matthew will quote from Isaiah chapter 7 in verse 23 of Matthew 1. He will do that. So Isaiah 7 is clearly in Matthew's mind here. Now, in Isaiah 7, a well-known chapter, or some bits of it at least well-known, Isaiah says more about the coming Messiah than simply he will be born of a virgin and he will be given the name Emmanuel. He goes on, in fact, to say something very interesting. The very next verse, that's in verse 14 of Isaiah 7. In verse 15 of Isaiah 7, he says this of the coming Messiah. He says, "He shall eat curds and honey." He shall eat curds and honey. Now you think, what the dickens is that about? Why are we being told he shall eat curds and honey? Well, it becomes clear as you continue in Isaiah 7 what it's all about. God is soon going to judge Judah. And he's going to judge Judah by sending against her a foreign power who will impoverish her and will strip her of all her resources, so that when the Messiah emerges, born of a virgin, he will emerge in a context where the staple diet is not meat and bread, but something much more modest, just curds and honey. That's all that there will be to eat when the Messiah emerges. Such will be the poverty and the degradation of the context in which he emerges. And so Isaiah is very clear then, God's judgment is not going to recede before Messiah comes, but it will still be the prevailing reality when Messiah comes. And that seems to be the perspective then that Matthew is coming from here. Yes, we've said there had been that decree from Emperor Cyrus, and there had been that return of some Jews to Jerusalem, and there had been that rebuilding of the temple and the walls and so on. But you know, it was all very low-key, wasn't it? And inconclusive. Judah never regained her independence. She just became this toothless vassal territory under the control of successive powers, after the Persians, the Greeks, and then after the Greeks, the Romans. And so, as I say, then Matthew here, he shares Isaiah's perspective, and he's saying, in a real sense, Judah does still languish under God's judgment. Now, we've so far identified then these two very contrasting themes in this genealogy. On the one hand, Matthew is emphasizing the greatness of this king. He's the special ruler who's promised of old. And yet, on the other hand, Matthew is emphasizing the grimness of Judah's plight. Judah is a people in exile. Now, surely then, when you bring those two emphases together, it can mean only one thing, which is this. The great thing that this great king is going to do is he's going to bring an end to that grim plight. And he is going to ingather the exiles of his people. And again, that's straight out of Isaiah, isn't it? It's straight out of the passage we read earlier on, Isaiah 11. Remember how in that chapter, in the first part of Isaiah 11, Isaiah prophesies regarding the character of the coming Messiah, how through the ministry of the Holy Spirit in his life he's going to be so full of grace and beauty. And there, but then you jump to the last part of Isaiah 11, and there Isaiah prophesies regarding the work of this Messiah. What's he going to do? What will be his mission? Well, it's going to be an ingathering of exiles, isn't it? That's what Isaiah says. Look at verse 11. In that day, so that's the day of this shoot from the stump of Jesse. In that day, the Lord will extend his hand yet a second time to recover the remnant that remains of his people from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Cush, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamath, and from the coastlands of the sea. Or you go down to verse 16, that beautiful image. There will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant that remains of his people. So I'm saying then, Matthew here, taking his cue from Isaiah, he's depicting Jesus not only as a king, but as a king emerging in a context of divine banishment, divine expulsion, in order to end that banishment, end that expulsion, and ingather the exiles. Now, we're almost ready to move on to our third main point this morning, but just a quick footnote before we do so. We've said that the third section of this genealogy, from verse 12 down to verse 16, that's the section then where Judah is languishing under God's judgment. I wonder if any of you have spotted anything irregular about that section of the genealogy. Because there is something irregular, and it's this. There are only actually 13 generations mentioned. So in the first section, you start with Abraham and you finish with David. That makes 14 generations. The second section, you start with Solomon. You finish with Jeconiah. 14 generations. The third section, you start with Shealtiel. You finish with Jesus. 13 generations. What should we make of that? You might think, we shouldn't make anything of that. I mean, it's such a fine detail that you barely even notice it. Well, we might barely notice it, but that's because we're not terribly genealogically inclined. But the first audiences to whom Matthew was writing, they would have noticed it because they were very attuned to this kind of thing. And so what is Matthew doing here? Why does he omit a generation in the third section of the genealogy? Well, there have been different suggestions, and of the different suggestions, I think probably Don Carson's has the most going for it. He thinks it indicates God's mercy. God, in his pity for his people, cutting short the period of judgment and hastening the coming of the king who would ingather the exiles. Because that's what God is like, isn't it? He's rich in mercy, Paul tells us. He doesn't relish judgment. Where judgment is necessary, he executes it. But the deepest impulses in God are to relent and to spare and to extend mercy. It's a beautiful thing about our God. Some of you perhaps have lost sight of that. And your notions of God have become distorted and disfigured. He's morphed into this sadistic being who enjoys inflicting pain and misery. That's not the God of the Bible. That's not the God Matthew believes in. Matthew's God doesn't persist in judgment mode a moment longer than he has to. A generation goes out of the window here because of God's haste to send Jesus on his exile in gathering mission. A beautiful touch emphasizing the pity, the mercy of our God. So Jesus inherits the throne, Jesus gathers the exiles, and then the third statement Matthew is making, Jesus includes the misfits. Jesus includes the misfits. Now, this concept that we've been talking about then of Jesus as the king who and gathers the exiles, it might sound good, but it soon runs into a couple of awkward questions. So question number one, if in fact there had been at the time of Cyrus a return of the Jews to Jerusalem, then what exactly is this in gathering of the exiles now going to look like? And then question number two, Matthew's gospel will proceed eventually to a climax involving Jesus dying on a cross. Well, how does that bring about an ingathering of exiles? Well, this is the point, surely. The exile that Jesus had come to reverse, yes, was pictured by the deportation to Babylon in 586. But was actually much profounder than the deportation to Babylon. The exile that Jesus had come to reverse was actually the original exile, the exile from Eden. Again, that's made clear in Isaiah chapter 11. We've talked about the first part of Isaiah 11 and its focus on the Messiah's character. We've talked about the last part of Isaiah 11 and its focus on the Messiah's work. What about the middle part of Isaiah 11? What's it about? Well, it focuses on what those exiles are going to be ingathered to by the Messiah. There's this Messiah coming who's going to ingather the exiles. There's going to be that highway, as he's put it in verse 16. What are the exiles going to be ingathered to? We're told in the middle section. They're going to be ingathered to a realm in which creation functions harmoniously. Verses 6 to 8, the wolf dwelling with the lamb, the leopard lying down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, the cow and the bear. And so it goes on. A realm that's been freed from the curse. A realm in which God dwells. Verse 9 refers to my holy mountain. A realm in which God is known. Verse 9 refers to the knowledge of the Lord. And so you get the picture, this ingathering that the Messiah is going to effect. It isn't really about conveying people from Persia to Jerusalem. It's about conveying people from God's banishment and curse and into a new world. Whereas we sang earlier, Eden is restored, paradise regained, the curse removed, God's presence experienced again. It's interesting, actually, the very opening words of Matthew 1 here are literally in the Greek, the book of Genesis. And the first book of Genesis, of course, is about a king, Adam, who messes up, and because of him, there's exile, there's expulsion from Eden. Matthew is saying that here now, I'm writing a new book of Genesis about a new king, Jesus, who will gather the exiles from that place of outsideness and will bring them back and restore them to Eden. And that's why then the climax of his mission is dying on a cross. There on that cross, Jesus is going to be banished by God, banished into the outer darkness, so that Matthew will record him crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's going to be exiled in order that those who were exiled through Adam's failure may be ingathered, may be brought home, may be restored to what was lost in Genesis chapter 3. And once we've established all of that then, once we've established that the exile Jesus had come to reverse was that original exile from Eden, we're ready to bring in another dimension of this. And it's this, the ingathering then isn't just for Judah. Didn't Isaiah also make that clear? Didn't Isaiah make it clear that there's an international flavor to this ingathering? Verse 10 of Isaiah 11, in that day the root of Jesse will stand as a signal for the peoples. Of him shall the nations inquire. And verse 12, he will raise a signal for the nations, Isaiah says. And so Jesus in gathering includes people from the nations, not just the Jews, because that exile from Eden, it was a human problem, not a Jewish problem. And so King Jesus comes to ingather not merely Jews, but to ingather those from the nations. And I think Matthew himself brings that out here in his genealogy in one very fascinating way. I'm sure your attention has been drawn to this before, but the four women that he mentions. You don't expect him to mention mothers in this genealogy. It's almost entirely father dominated, but there are those four women mentioned, or four women prior to Mary actually, who's mentioned at the end. There's Tamar, and there's Rahab, and there's Ruth, and there's the wife of Uriah. All of whom are not only women, but all of whom are foreigners. Tamar, a Canaanite, we may almost certainly conclude. Rahab, certainly a Canaanite from Jericho. Ruth, a Moabitess. Bathsheba, probably actually an Israelite, it seems, from a genealogy in Chronicles, but her husband is a Hittite, and so she basically becomes regarded as a Hittite. These four foreigners in the genealogy of Jesus, Matthew making the point in that way that this king has come to ingather exiles from the nations, not just from Judah. It's why, probably too, Matthew stresses the connection to Abraham. Abraham, the one who had received that promise from God that in you the nations will be blessed. And actually, once we start thinking about those four women, we begin to realize, don't we, that they're not just striking for their ethnicity, but in more general terms, they're such unlikely members of the genealogy. I mean, three of them are widows, aren't they? Tamar is a widow, and Ruth is a widow, and Bathsheba is a widow. Two of them have been badly mistreated. Tamar has been mistreated by Judah, her father-in-law, who should have given her to his son, according to Israelite law. Two sons of Judah had been married to her and had died. The third son should have been given Tamar, but Judah didn't do that. Tamar was mistreated by Judah. And then, of course, Bathsheba mistreated her husband, killed by David. One of these women has a very checkered background. Rahab, the prostitute from Jericho. And so we have here, surely, Matthew saying not just that this king will ingather foreigners, but he will ingather misfits, the most unlikely, those whom you never expect, those who would seem to be beyond the pale, those whom you would never envisage. And so I want to wrap all this up this morning then by just asking all of us the question: are we part of this ingathering of exiles by King Jesus? All of us are part of that banishment from Eden that took place at a very early point in the history of this world. All of us, through our forefather Adam, were cast out of God's presence. That's the situation into which we're born. We're born into exile, all of us are. We're born outside of Eden. We're born in a state of enmity from the God who made us for communion with himself. King Jesus has come to gather in exiles, to restore them to paradise, to restore them ultimately to a new world in which there'll be no more sin, no more sadness, no more curse, a world where God will be known and enjoyed perfectly. Are you part of that? Have you responded to this King? Have you said, Jesus, I want to be one of your gathered exiles. I want to be under your kingship. I want to be part of this highway. I want to walk this highway that you're establishing. Back to Eden, back to paradise. This highway into a new world. Is King Jesus your rescuer this morning? It's been in the news, hasn't it, these past days, about the comments of the leader of Windsor Council, and how for the royal wedding that's coming up in a few months' time, he wants all the homeless to be removed from the streets, because of course you can't possibly have homeless people destroying the photographs when there's a prince around. Matthew's saying here that this King, the great King, he doesn't come for the successful, the eminent, the wealthy. He comes for the misfits. Perhaps this morning you feel like a misfit. And you think, well, this great vision that you've portrayed this morning of walking on this highway into a new world, the saints going marching in as we sing in the old chorus, I couldn't possibly be part of that because look at me. I'm just not the right kind of person. Well, Matthew is saying King Jesus, he came through the chain of people like Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba because he came for people like them. He came for misfits, excluded, outsiders, beyond the pale. No one, therefore, is ineligible. No one is too bad, no one is too broken, no one is in too difficult a life situation. Anybody can come and be part of this homecoming that Jesus is ushering in. And so this morning, if you haven't yet cried out to Jesus, cry out to him and say, Lord Jesus, I want to be one of your ingathered exiles. Amen.